This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Donald Trump has made China one of the defining issues of his presidency. He seems to have done everything he can to provoke China. He's ignited a trade war, he's escalated tensions over North Korea, and much more. And yet instead of backing the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, Trump has reportedly told President Xi Jinping that the United States would remain silent about democracy as they worked out their trade deal. The protests in Hong Kong against Beijing's rule have been going on now for months. Combined with slowing economic growth across the country, they've created a political crisis for Xi Jinping, right at a time when the Communist Party is supposed to be celebrating its 70th year in power. The situation is more serious than anything since the Tiananmen Square uprising a generation ago. Two of our staff writers are recently back from China, Evan Osnos and Jiayang Fan. Jiayang, you just got back from Hong Kong, and I want to get a sense first the emotional tenor of what's going on in the streets. What kinds of people are participating, and what's the feeling out there?
I would say 80% of the participants are middle class, working class. They range in age from probably 20 to 75. The folks I spoke to feel just so strongly that they are there to support the freedom that they have understood to be part and parcel of Hong Kong society. I think many of them are undecided about how far they're willing to go, and most of them would claim they're not what's known as frontline protesters.
What is a frontline protester mean?
Right. A frontline protester is the ones that have been featured so prominently in Western media, the ones wearing the gas masks, clad in all black. They occasionally throw the Molotov cocktails and resort to more extreme measures. I think it's really important to point out that that's a pretty minor fraction of the overall community of protesters.
Now, my understanding is that this began with fairly limited demands. It had to do with extradition, for example. And with time, that has broadened. And do these protesters have the sense that they can keep apart from Beijing indefinitely?
When I pose that question to protesters, many of them don't have a very clearly defined answer, and I would dare to say that many of them probably don't even know themselves. What they do feel is the anger that comes from the failure of the umbrella movement, which happened in 2014 over this fight for universal suffrage that did not succeed. And this accumulated sense of anger and grievances that have not properly been met in any way. It's important to say that Hong Kong was never a democracy, even under Britain, but they felt that this was the direction in which they were moving. So there was just this rising panic that Hong Kong was becoming like another mainland city, utterly under the thumb of the Communist Party.
So real fear of being sucked in.
Exactly.
So while
Jiang was in Hong Kong, Evan, on the front lines and dodging Molotov cocktails and the rest. You were in Beijing for the 70th anniversary of the revolution. How were the Chinese officials that you were talking to talking about Hong Kong, and how was the Hong Kong drama playing out on the Chinese media?
Well, the contrast really couldn't be more stark. In Beijing, the subject of Hong Kong and its protests has nothing to do with idealism or with young people who are trying to create economic opportunities for themselves or to hold off Beijing's control. It is described in Beijing consistently as a, quote, separatist movement. They think of it as an attempt to try to divide Chinese territory, which, after all, is this very visceral, very specific accusation, because any Chinese person will tell you that the country over the course of history has been invaded and has been carved up. And so by talking about it as an assault on Chinese territory, that's tapping into a very deep political well. And they were doing that to a great extent recently because, after all, they're celebrating 70 years of the People's Republic of China. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by saying we have been able to pull together the country in ways that previous governments never had. And that means resisting things like these protests in Hong Kong.
And how has Xi Jinping handled the protests? Do you expect that the crackdown will become more violent, more stringent than it's already been?
Well, I would not expect that they're going to give in to the protesters' demands. Frankly, there was just no indication in Beijing, and anybody that I've been talking to involved in the sort of strategy about this subject thinks that China is ready to make a deal with Hong Kong. But, you know, the obvious fear, the thing that people have been worried about, is some sort of repeat of the events of 1989 when China cracked down on demonstrators in Tiananmen Square and you had a massacre in which students and other people in the city were killed. But at the same time, there are very real pressures, I think, that are on Xi Jinping not to handle it the same way they handled it in 1989. If they went into Hong Kong today with tanks, for instance, as they did in Beijing, you know, this would devastate a financial capital that is very important to China's economy. It's got a stock market larger than London's. It's a big source of foreign currency. And more importantly, it would devastate China's effort to try to establish itself on the global stage as an alternative to American leadership. And so I think the more likely scenario is that China will keep up the pressure and gradually use its sheer weight and persistence to try to grind down the resistance of protesters in Hong Kong.
Jiang, do you think that people in Hong Kong expect a Tiananmen Square-type scenario to take place, or do they feel that that kind of pressure is not on them, that they can go much farther?
Some of the folks I've talked to certainly think that that is a possibility. There is this sense of Shenzhen right across the border, and there being People's Liberation Army barracks there, and also an increase of troops even stationed in Hong Kong. I think there is also among the young this sense of nihilism, this feeling that if the tanks really do roll in, let the world see how brutal the communist regime is. And this is, I would say, again, among the 20 to even 10% of the of the frontline protesters who, for better or worse, command a lot of attention because they're the ones who are, you know, some of them are talking to Western media and they're the ones throwing the Molotov cocktails.
One of the things that's most striking watching these protests is the sense of the extensive surveillance network that the Chinese government has put into play. How are the protesters able to get around that or not?
You'll see in pictures that they are so fully armored in, you know, scarves, masks, covering every part of their body. I mean, and you have to imagine these are 90-degree days in Hong Kong, and they're covered head to toe, even their ears. And I've been told it's because there is worry or suspicion that the AI is so advanced that even the shape of one's ears can be monitored.
And that's true, or that's paranoia, or true?
I think AI is quite sophisticated. I'm not sure to the extent that the ear shapes can be monitored, but that sense of fear is warranted, I believe.
there was a very telling moment when the Hong Kong protesters started to attack the smart lampposts, as they're called. These are the obviously the sort of nodes of surveillance that have cameras and listening equipment and so on. And they're in their own way, these are the perfect expressions, the physical expressions of China's future governance model. It believes that in the future it can optimize the powers of a one-party state by doing what an old analog state never could. It could never listen in on every conversation. It could never track people as they moved around a city. Well, technology allows that now. And that's one of the ways that this government imagines that it's going to try to extend its longevity. I mean, it is, after all, at a very acute moment in its own history. It's been in power 70 years. It's surpassed the longevity of the Soviet Union, but it is acutely aware that one-party states do not have a long lifespan. And so Xi Jinping's personal determination is to try to, you know, in some sense, prevent the inertia of history from coming down on top of him.
Jiang, Xi Jinping has, for all intents and purposes, made himself president for life. I don't see it any other way. What conditions allowed him to consolidate power so swiftly and effectively?
I think early on, his corruption campaign, which really won the hearts and minds of the citizenry across China, was a very astute way to fight political enemies. I think when he came to power, he realized that there were still lingering factions. And one has to understand that even within the Communist Party, there's a lot of infighting. And the greatest threat to a political leader is not actually the people protesting or even, you know, the economy, but other rivaling factions trying to topple him. I think he also very deftly nursed this cult of personality. He thinks that he really is, you know, a national deity. He has convinced the people that only he can lead the country into superpower status, the transition really from the century of shame that China has experienced, at least in the Chinese narrative, at the hands of foreign powers, to a nation that will ultimately outdo the United States.
Well, journalists are known, of course, as great mind readers, so I'll let you exercise that capacity here. How does Xi Jinping see a figure like Donald Trump?
Take the two of them, put them side by side for a minute. Xi Jinping began his career in the very center of party power, grew up in Beijing. His father was a senior party leader. Xi Jinping spent his entire career essentially moving up the ladder of obscure party posts until eventually, you know, at one point he was the head of the Feed Association in a rural province. He makes his way up, becomes governor of provinces, and then finally gets his chance by keeping his mouth closed. He never let on to his peers what he believed, never created a lot of enemies in the system, and using that method, he made his way to the top. Now look at Donald Trump. They are in every conceivable stylistic and personal way different. And I think Xi Jinping looks across the table at Donald Trump and finds him utterly mystifying. One of the things that's happened over the last 2 years is that everything that Chinese diplomats and politicians had come to believe about how American politics works has been chucked out the window. And so Xi Jinping has no trust in what Donald Trump tells him. He doesn't trust him on the trade war. He doesn't trust him on these assurances of one thing or another. And so he's coming from a position of total and complete self-protection first, and do not rely on the United States for anything.
It was so interesting to me. I was watching on television some of these protests, and you see occasionally an American flag being waved or a British flag being waved. And at the same time, President Trump has been absolutely silent about these protests. He's not said one word of encouragement or praise or pro-democratic sentiment. Jiang, how is that being received on the streets of Hong Kong?
I asked one of the protesters who was wielding the American flag, I asked what her intention was, and she said, in this war, there is no one who's powerful enough to save Hong Kong except possibly the U.S. And we need to make sure the U.S. knows how exactly critical the situation is here And then I followed up with a question about Trump and what she thought of Trump's response. And she said, I can't get bogged down the details right now. All I need is for some of the politicians in Washington to see.
But surely they're aware that this is a president who does not press human rights issues on the Chinese leadership, has not mentioned democratic values to the Chinese leadership. If anything, his greatest emphasis lately is, besides trade, which is a big issue, is to get the Chinese, as with other countries, to investigate the Biden family.
Which is why I think some of the pro-Beijing folks that I spoke to was really, is really encouraged, frankly, that Trump won the election instead of Hillary, and the sense that this is not a concern for Washington, and that at the end of the day, Trump is only interested in making a deal, and human rights was never high on his agenda. So when push comes to shove, especially with the trade war, the fact that Trump might be looking for leverage or for kind of pawns, that Hong Kong just might be one of, you know, the cards that he has to play. I think many of the pro-Beijing folks that I talk to are fairly happy that Trump is in command right now.
Just recently, Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, said, China will never interfere in the internal affairs of the United States, and we trust that the American people are capable of sorting out their own problems. In this context, I'd ask you both, does that mean that they're likely to take a pass on investigating the Bidens or interfering in the 2020 elections?
I think, yeah, they do not particularly want to get involved here. I think this is one in which I will take them at face value. And I'll give you one data point.
Why does that make them different from the Russians? The Russians seem to love to thrive on the idea of chaos in in American public life as a result of, or at least partly as a result of, their interference in the election and, by extension, Trump's victory. Why would the Chinese not feel the same way? Chinese thrive on something else?
Well, China loves the fact that the United States is engaged in these kinds of, you know, obviously paralyzing internal fights. That's just been very helpful to China on the world stage. But at the same time, China is prudent about not wanting to provoke any more response than it needs to. And I'll give you a useful bit of history on this, which is that China actually, we know this, this is not a hidden fact, China hacked into the 2008 campaign, according to U.S. intelligence agencies, but it never weaponized the information. It never used it. It never pushed it back out into the public sphere the way that Russia did. What it did is it really used it for intelligence gathering purposes. It hoovered up this stuff and held on to it for its own sense of trying to predict what was going to happen. China would be much happier to watch the United States go through its own paroxysms of political disorder than to risk the possibility of engendering some American backlash by actively intervening.
Jiang and Evan, if you had to guess, who are the Chinese rooting for to win the presidential election and why?
I think that Elizabeth Warren is someone that China would not want to win the election. The sense that she is someone who seems to have convictions about human rights and someone who will not let China get away with what it does within its borders, I think is worrying. I think someone like Bernie Sanders is someone who can be more attractive because Bernie at least doesn't seem to have much interest in getting involved.
Evan?
In general, the Communist Party prefers Republican presidents in the United States because they're, in a sense, more likely to be business-oriented. They're going to be pro-trade and so on. But this Republican president has scrambled the circuits to such a degree in Beijing that they really don't know. And they're, in some sense, they're edging towards the known quantities. They've worked with Joe Biden as a vice president. They feel a little bit more familiar with him. He's frankly one of the only names that they really know out of this field. So they're watching it very carefully, but they are at this point totally undone by Donald Trump, and they don't really believe that he would be a reliable counterparty.
Evan Osnos and Jiayang Fan, I know you're still suffering from jet lag coming back from China. My thanks to you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks so much.
Jiayang Fan and Evan Osnos. Both are staff writers, and you can read all their coverage of China at newyorker.com. Now, the Turkish offensive against the Kurds in Syria has put our longtime allies in horrendous danger, and casualties are mounting. On our podcast, Politics and More, Dexter Filkins joins Dorothy Wickenden to talk about the Turkish invasion and how the president's withdrawal of U.S. troops has outraged even some of his diehard supporters, including Lindsey Graham. Dexter covered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he'll explain why the power vacuum created by the United States pullout is so dangerous. That's in Politics and More, a podcast from The New Yorker. And there's more to come here on The New Yorker Radio Hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for being with us today. I'm David Remnick. For reasons that are pretty obvious, Richard Nixon's name has been coming up all the time in the news lately, and one of the most acute portraits of the late president was an essay by Michael Korda that ran in The New Yorker in 1994. Korda got to know Nixon pretty well during the long years after the ex-president left Washington.
There is a theory that great men have large heads and prominent features. Think of Charles de Gaulle and his nose, LBJ and his ears, FDR and his jaw. And by this standard, if no other, Richard Nixon had reached greatness. His head was enormous. His jowls and ski jump nose were just as cartoonists had always portrayed them. His eyes dark and penetrating. Most striking of all was his voice, a deep, rumbling basso profundo, rather like an avalanche in the distance.
Michael Korda and Nixon weren't exactly friends. Korda was his editor. He worked on the books that Nixon published with Simon & Schuster, and in 1989, he was invited to a dinner at Nixon's home in Saddle River, New Jersey. And on that night, it turned out, the former president was conducting a little shadow diplomacy of his own, something very much on our minds right now. Here's Dylan Baker reading from Michael Korda's account of that night with Greg Stirr as Richard Nixon.
Within a mile or so of a New Jersey commercial strip full of mini malls and service stations, Nixon's house was tucked away as secretly as Shangri-La. Behind high, dense growths of trees and hedges, it was impossible for any casual intruder to find, rather like any number of cul-de-sacs in Bel Air, but without palm trees. Nixon's staff had presented me with careful instructions on how to reach the house, but it seemed a little puzzled that I was driving myself. Their puzzlement became clear as I pulled up before the entrance. A row of limousines to one side made it evident that Nixon's guests tended to be driven by chauffeurs. I had driven my silver Porsche. The courtyard was a blacktop space big enough for a good-sized motel. The security people at the door seemed uncertain what to make of the car, though whether because it was frivolous or foreign, I wasn't sure. Inside, I found most of my fellow guests milling about in the entrance hall, looking suitably solemn. I recognized Robert Abplanalp, a large, jovial-looking man who had been in the limelight as a Nixon backer and personal friend during Watergate. There was the CEO of Archer Daniels Midland, an assistant secretary of state, and a former U.S. representative to NATO. There were also three Chinese gentlemen, all with the bland, inscrutable faces of professional diplomats. The senior of them was Han Xu, China's departing ambassador. There were no women present. It was to be a stag dinner. Nixon appeared at the top of the stairs at exactly the moment we had been summoned for. He descended halfway, stretched out his arms just as he used to do when he was campaigning, with a broad smile.
"Gentlemen, the good news is the bar is open."
As I was shortly to discover, drinks in the Nixon household were not to be taken or even held lightly. They were served in immense, heavy tumblers, and every time a guest took a sip, Nixon, who had an eagle eye as a host, would attract the butler's attention.
"You'd better freshen up Mr. Korda's drink."
I ordered one of his famous daiquiris made with almost no sugar, the recipe for which was said to be one of his more closely guarded secrets. The president claimed to make the best daiquiri ever, and I can report that it lived up to expectations. What I was not prepared for was the odd formality that he imposed on himself and his guests. There was no conversation as such. One guest had just returned that day from Paris, where the Cambodian talks were going on. Nixon asked him to give us a report on the subject, which he did, at some length, while we sat and listened. When he was through, Nixon gave us his views on the subject, during which absolute silence reigned, while the butler freshened up our drinks. The three Chinese men, who were presumably accustomed to feigning interest at the interminable meetings of the Communist Party, gave these disquisitions their full, rapt attention, while most of the Americans gently slumbered, arms crossed in front of them, chins resting on their chests. What kept my attention focused was not the subject of Cambodia, but the fact that Nixon was in the habit of referring to himself in the third person, something I had never heard anyone do before, not even members of the British royal family.
"When Nixon was president,"
he'd say, his dark eyes flickering over his guests as if he expected one of us to challenge him.
"When Nixon was president and leader of the free world,"
as if leader of the free world were also an office to which he had been elected. Roused by the announcement that dinner was ready, we filed into the dining room, where the first course proved to be a contribution from Mr. Abplanalp, who had branched out from manufacturer of aerosol valves for spray cans to entrepreneur of smoked fish. While we ate our smoked tuna, smoked trout, and smoked salmon, the real purpose of the dinner became apparent. The massacre of the Chinese student protesters in Tiananmen Square had occurred only 2 months earlier, and Nixon was debating whether he should continue with his plans to revisit China. The former representative and ambassador to NATO, Robert Ellsworth, brought up the key question, the piece de resistance, as it were, which was how America was reacting to Tiananmen Square and whether Nixon should go to Beijing. Han Xu and the other diplomats came to full attention at this. I could not help admiring the way Nixon had managed to get somebody else to raise the question, and the way he gave it careful scrutiny, as if it had caught him by surprise. He knotted his brows.
I believe that there is more to be gained by going than not. Some people...
He frowned darkly.
Some people, naysayers, parlor liberals, professional skeptics, would doubtless criticize Nixon. Nixon is used to that. It's never stopped Nixon in the past.
The Chinese nodded.
Great powers cannot allow their foreign policy to be determined by the scruples or prejudices of the liberal media.
A deeper nod, with a hint of puzzlement from the Chinese, for whom media scruples were surely not a problem.
The interests and the good relations of two such powers as China and the United States are more important than transitory events. Ordinary Americans like and respect China and are not dismayed by the horror stories.
He leaned close to Han Xu, who continued to eat methodically and with enthusiasm while the translator whispered in his ear.
When Nixon was president and leader of the free world, we had troubles of our own in the United States. We, too, had so-called student riots, protests, anarchy in the streets of Washington. When you go home, you tell your people that many of us understand. When Nixon was president and leader of the free world, he found that firmness paid. You tell them that.
The Chinese smiled for the first time. Firmness had so far been a hard sell for them in the United States, even in the Bush White House, where running over students with tanks was seen, at the very least, as poor PR for the Beijing regime. Han Xu finished what was on his plate, put his knife and fork down neatly, and raised his glass of red wine, a gift from the president of France, we had been informed, in a gesture of gratitude, not quite a toast, but by no means casual either. He whispered something to the translator. He is grateful for the president's understanding, the translator said. He will communicate it all home.
Good.
We withdrew to a somber room with a huge rough stone fireplace. While my fellow guests got down to the serious business of the evening, telling old political war stories from the Nixon campaign and drinking monster stingers, I followed Nixon, who had offered to show the diplomats around the house. Most of the rooms had a certain formal, unlived-in quality, rather like an expensive hotel suite, or, more to the point, the White House. The unlived-in feeling apparently extended to Nixon. At one point, he opened a closet door, apparently thinking that it was the door to his study, then slammed it shut hastily with a muttered oath.
Son of a bitch.
Like people lost in a museum, we circled aimlessly for some time, admiring the ceremonial gifts on display that Nixon had received from other heads of state. Lucky on the second try, he flung open the door to his study and ushered us in.
This is where Nixon works.
It was difficult to imagine any work being done in this unused room. It had something of the quality of a stage set furnished with expensive new props. There was not a paper in sight, and the desktop, like everything else in the room, was polished, spotless, and apparently brand new.
"This is the desk at which Nixon wrote all his books."
He patted its shiny leather top affectionately, as if it were a horse. We stood uncomfortably around the empty desk, and then Nixon told Han Shu that he wanted him to have a souvenir of his visit, something which would convey the American spirit.
"There was a man in the 40s and 50s whom Nixon had always respected as a true patriot, a man who made great sacrifices for the truth and had been martyred. That man wrote a book, one of the most important books of the 20th century, a book that every American ought to read, and not just American either. His message is universal."
Nixon bent down and opened the bottom drawer of his big desk and withdrew a copy of Whittaker Chambers' Witness. I was fascinated to see that the drawer was full of hardcover copies of Chambers' book. Had Nixon bought up the entire stock? Briefly, Nixon summed up Chambers' role in the Alger Hiss case, explaining to the three communist bureaucrats the undoing of a communist conspiracy in the United States and the way the liberal media persecuted all those who had tried to bring the truth to light, Nixon himself not excepted. Han Shu showed every sign of agreement with this view of history, and after Nixon autographed a copy of Witness for him, he clutched it to his bosom as if it were the Holy Grail. We returned to the fireplace, where the atmosphere, fueled with stingers, was getting boisterous. Nixon, I could tell, had had enough of the Chinese by now, and they seemed to have tired of him, too. I took my leave with them. It was a testimony to Nixon's power that he could make his world, the world of exile, seem more real than the world around him, that he could create somehow the illusion that he was still the president, that Watergate had never happened, that the bombing of Cambodia or the shooting of the Kent State students hadn't really mattered, and that Whittaker Chambers was an American hero. Nixon walked us outside to shake hands. He saw the Chinese into their waiting limo, then said good night to me. He looked across the blacktop at my Porsche and studied it carefully.
"What the hell is that?"
Greg Stir as Richard Nixon and Dylan Baker, reading from Michael Korda's essay, Nixon, Mine Host. It was published in The New Yorker in 1994. Just ahead, a passionate music fan encounters a sound that he's never heard before. The vocal group, Room Full of Teeth. That's in a minute on The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud. with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Burkhard Bilger is a staff writer and a man of wide interests: technology, science, nature, sports, food, Southern culture, German history, and much more. Burke also happens to be a good musician. He's been singing in choirs since he was young, and he keeps a guitar in his office where he's always noodling on it. He taught his kids to play old-time music and launched the Bilger Family Band. And as his kids grew up, they in turn expanded his musical horizons.
So my son is a bassist, upright bassist and jazz bassist, and was the first one who told me about Roomful of Teeth. And so, I don't know, a few years ago, he played me Partita, the Caroline Shaw piece, and I just thought it was astonishing. I've been listening to choral music my whole life, and I'd never heard anything like this before.
Every year, the members of Roomful of Teeth get together for a summer residency. They rehearse new pieces. They bring in composers who are going to write material for them to perform in the coming year. The residency is at Mass MoCA, which is a museum in an old industrial town in Massachusetts. And one summer, Burke Bilger tagged along.
Roomful of Teeth is a vocal octet, so four men, four women, who sing contemporary classical music. They sing only newly composed pieces. So we're sitting in a loft space on the second floor of one of the mill buildings in Mass MoCA. It's a huge room with enormous high ceilings, I don't know, 12, 13 feet high. And there's some onlookers, but also kind of a semicircle of composers with a singer in the middle. And this is a process that always happens at Mass MoCA with Roomful of Teeth, where they'll spend a day just having each singer introduce themselves to the composers and giving them a sense of exactly what their abilities are, what they like to do, what they don't like to do, where their voice can go, where it can't go, what their range is.
Yeah. So, like, it would be really easy to have little bits of breaks like that if it were... because that would be belted, and then I'd be like, it's just high, like, resonance.
Esli Gomez is the highest soprano in the group. She was the youngest member of the group when she joined.
Yeah, it was my first year out of undergrad when I heard about the premise and took a train from New Haven to New York and did a Skype audition with Brad. And I did a Bulgarian folk song, a jazz song, a Schumann, you know, art song, and a Handel, like, rage aria. And I was, like, so relieved that I wasn't auditioning for grad schools. I was like, I don't have to fit in this weird box that doesn't make sense yet. And then heard about this and was like, that sounds like
that's
me.
It.
That sounds
it.
Better.
That's better for grad school.
Yeah.
Maybe you can give us an example of you singing the styles you were talking about learning from the beginning.
All the members of the group are trained classical singers, but they incorporate techniques, vocal techniques from all over the world. Over the course of the day, as the singers come in one by one, they'll showcase all kinds of different techniques. Some people are expert tube and throat singers. Some people can do the deep carcarot.
That sort of sound.
Yodeling or belting. So you get a whole range of just astonishing capabilities of the human voice. I mean, I've been singing my whole life, and I'm used to what vocal music sounds like. And suddenly it's like hearing a saxophone sound like a violin and sound like a kettle drum and sounding like a bassoon. It's like, how did, I didn't know the voice could do that.
It's fun.
Western classical singing has for centuries been divided into essentially two techniques. There's choral singing, which is meant to blend and what we call straight tone without vibrato. And then there's bel canto, which is what we hear in opera, which is a very powerful, athletic vocal technique, which is designed to kind of vault over the sound of an orchestra and fill an entire concert hall. What's excluded from those two techniques is everything else in the world that people have done with the human voice. All these wonderful throat singing techniques and yodeling and belting and ways in which the voice can be rough or gritty or kind of mess with all what we think of as kind of pure classical technique.
The way composers have used choirs over the last 100 years, I started to feel like there was a certain sense of straitjacketedness.
Now, Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Roomful of Teeth. He founded this group in 2008 in order to bring in these new techniques. And part of that was inviting singers from all over the world to instruct them in these techniques.
We can reach out and bring somebody from Central Asia and hear them sing and ask them questions and have them teach us for a while about a completely different way of using their voice. You know, where the larynx sits, how much constriction, how much air. All those things are really just basic physiological things, and they manifest in all these different ways around the world. And I thought if composers could get their hands on this and see what's possible, and singers could play with it and stretch the color range of their own voices, then what we understand as choral music might become much more variegated.
So it's really not about we're going to become tube and throat singers or pansori singers or canto tonori singers?
Not at all, no. It's really just a kind of pushing the bounds, pushing the walls of what's beautiful in a way. It's like finding what people consider as beautiful and letting composers play with that and see what emerges.
One of the composers at Mass MoCA this week is Eve Beglarian, a really adventurous New York composer. She's setting a piece by Walt Whitman to music. But in the meantime, she's trying to see what new kinds of sounds she could make with the group. So what's your plan for this afternoon? What are you going to do with the group to get ready for this?
Driving down, I happened to hear Elvis Presley's cover of Blue Moon. And it's so held back. I mean, he's very close mic'd. And from what I can tell, there's different processing on the two double tracks. One of them has a really striking slapback echo.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart.
So I'm thinking we can try setting up our own cover of Elvis's cover. And try having different people paired to do different aspects of the tune. I mean, it may be totally dumb. I don't know. We'll see. So I thought what we could do is set up the accompaniment for now, right? Let's start with
It's late in the afternoon in the loft, and Beglarian is working with the group. She's playing around with the sounds they can make, trying to see what tools might end up working in the piece she's composing.
And, okay, and I put up the lyrics. Maybe the two of you to start. Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart. Right? So that you can use all the breath you need to do the whispery, consonant-y thing.
Can I hear just by yourself what you're doing?
You saw me standing alone.
It's really weird.
Can we try this with everybody? Let's just try that. Okay, so from the top.
Ba-doom, doom, 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 doom.
Thing. That is so not my jam.
So
sorry.
I'm with you entirely. Entirely. I'm so with you. Okay, let's hold off on that. Let's you two trade the whispery consonant-y thing, and let's just see what happens there.
Right? Should we just track each other?
Beglerian and the room full of teeth singers are kind of feeling their way together through these new sounds, these new techniques. You might say that what comes out of it are compositions that only a room full of teeth can sing because it's designed so specifically for their voices and their techniques. But the truth is that composers have always been pushing the bounds of the human voice. Mozart, when he wrote the Queen of the Night aria, did it for a specific soprano who could go very high and had a very mobile voice. And little by little, other sopranos learned to do the same thing. Brad Wells hopes that the same thing will happen with the room full of teeth compositions in the future. If the songs are good enough and the techniques are appealing enough, then more and more classical singers will learn how to throat sing, will learn how to yodel and belt and do Korean pansori. And Room Full of Teeth songs will start to sound like yesterday's classical music.
Staff writer Burkhard Bilger. We heard from members of Room Full of Teeth, as well as the composer Eve Beglerian. They have shows coming up in Boston, New York, Miami, East Lansing, and many more. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. Please make sure to join us next week when we'll bring you Jane Mayer's interview of one of the most powerful people in America right now, Nancy Pelosi. Till then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.